From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The Tin Drum was the first German film to win an Academy Award. The director, Volker Schlondorf, has a new film, The Handmaid's Tale, and it's his first American theatrical film. Coming up, Schlondorf speculates about making movies in a unified Germany. Also today, consumer advocate Alice Tepper Marlin tells us how to be a socially conscious shopper. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers what we lose in the translation when we read the subtitles of a foreign film. And Dr. John celebrates Mardi Gras. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. A federal grand jury in Alaska has indicted the Exxon Corporation on 5 criminal counts in connection with the 1989 oil spill off Valdez, Alaska. Attorney General Dick Thornburgh announced the indictments about a half an hour ago.
This is a criminal indictment, which, as I think one of your numbers said, throws the environmental book at Exxon. And I don't without endorsing that characterization. I think it's has some poetry to it anyway.
If convicted on the charges, Exxon could face a fine of up to $600 million over the accident. The Justice Department has been negotiating with Exxon for weeks in an effort to reach a plea agreement that would have avoided a long criminal trial. Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega today made the immediate disbanding of the U.S.-backed Contra rebels a condition for the peaceful transfer of power to his political opposition. Ortega was beaten by U.S.-backed presidential candidate Violeta Chamorro in an election held 2 days ago. Meanwhile, the Salvadoran military front, the FMLN, has weighed in with their view of the Nicaraguan election. Katie Davis has more from Mexico City.
The communique, read by an FMLN spokeswoman in its Mexico City office, expressed regret over the loss of Daniel Ortega, but lauded the Nicaraguan elections as an example to the world of the democratic commitment of the Sandinistas. The written statement, signed by 5 comandantes, said the FMLN will redouble its struggle to create democracy in El Salvador and called on the U.S. and Salvadoran governments to remove obstacles to negotiations to the end of the 10-year-old war. The communique did not address the question many observers are now asking, that is, what impact will the new government in Nicaragua have on the FMLN's presence in that country? The guerrilla movement has long used Managua as a base for communications and political operations. For National Public Radio, this is Katie Davis in Mexico City.
A letter bomb exploded today in the Madrid home of the president of Spain's national court. The judge was listed in serious condition after losing both hands and an eye. Police suspect the Basque armed separatist group, ETA. Al Goodman reports from Goodman.
The package had been examined by a bodyguard of 60-year-old Judge Fernando de Mateo, but to no avail. It exploded in his home after lunch. The national court over which the judge presides hears cases of terrorism, including those of ETA. The armed separatist group has killed more than 600 people in its 22-year struggle for the independence of Spain's Basque provinces. When a female prosecutor of the national court died in a suspected ETA attack last September, Judge De Mateo said publicly the fight against terrorism would continue. He became a victim today, even though a political party linked to ETA and a Spanish government minister had hinted recently that a new truce might be in the offing. For National Public Radio, I'm Al Goodman in Madrid.
On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher today as the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 14.64 points. It's NPR. The Supreme Court ruled today that prison officials can force inmates to take powerful antipsychotic drugs without a judge's consent. Voting 6-3 in a case from the state of Washington, the justices said prisoners' rights are safeguarded as long as staff psychiatrists say the drugs will help and not merely pacify the prisoners. Dissenting judges say the ruling means prison officials seeking to maintain order may force inmates to take dangerous, even life-threatening drugs with little regard for the prisoners' well-being. 5 months after their education summit with President Bush, the country's education goals were still at the top of the agenda today for the nation's governors. The state officials wrapped up their annual winter meeting in Washington. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
Governor Terry Branstad of Iowa, president of the National Governors Association, spent more time this afternoon defending the proposed goals than promoting them.
There's skepticism in some quarters, But we are dead serious about this. We intend to be held accountable.
The reason education professionals have reacted with skepticism is that even though all six goals sound good, the resources to back them up may not all be there. The six goals are that by the year 2000, all children will start school ready to learn. 9 out of 10 will finish high school, competent in English, history, geography, and be number one in the world in math and science. Schools will be drug and violence free, and every American will read and write. This isn't supposed to cost more money, but even if it does, the governor said, states and communities will be responsible for raising it, not the federal government. In July, the governor's education task force will meet to decide how to measure the progress. I'm Claudio Sanchez reporting.
NASA has begun fueling the space shuttle Atlantis as officials prepare for the sixth attempt to get the shuttle off the ground. Atlantis is scheduled to place a secret spy satellite into orbit. Weather conditions for the flight are not considered to be optimum, but launch officials are hopeful that the flight will take off. Bad weather was the reason for the last launch delay, which occurred on Monday. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Volker Schlondorf, is one of Germany's leading film directors. Along with Wim Wenders, Werner Herzog, and Rainer Werner Fassbinder, he started what became known as the New German Cinema. His 1979 film, The Tin Drum, was the first German film to win an Academy Award. Schlondorf's other movies include Swan in Love, Circle of Deceit, and The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum, which he co-directed with his wife, Margarita von Trotta. He also directed the TV adaptation of Death of a Salesman, which starred Dustin Hoffman and John Malkovich. While talks proceed on German reunification, Schlondorf is in the U.S., ready for the premiere of his first American theatrical release, The Handmaid's Tale. It stars Faye Dunaway, Robert Duvall, and Natasha Richardson, and is adapted from Margaret Atwood's allegorical novel. The story is set in the near future, when the U.S. has been taken over by right-wing fundamentalists. Women are forced to be wives, childbearers, or domestics. Pollution and nuclear accidents have left most women infertile. Fertile women are forced to serve as handmaids, surrogate breeders for infertile wives. After a period of indoctrination, fertile women undergo a handmaid's initiation ceremony.
Genetic engineering, artificial insemination. God, in his profound compassion, has seen fit to punish us, to send a plague of barrenness, a desert of infertility. You have been given this precious gift.
Precious gift.
You are fertile. You can give birth.
Precious gift.
You can give birth. You can give birth for our country.
Oh, precious gift.
May the Lord open.
May the Lord open.
Let the handmaids ascend.
You will look neither to the right nor to the left. You will remain steadfast and true. I pronounce you handmaids in the sight of God. Amen.
Volker Schlondorf, welcome to Fresh Air.
Hi.
You've said, I believe, that you didn't share The Handmaid's Tale's vision of the United States as evolving into a fascist society, and that you were actually reluctant to take
not.
The film at the beginning. Yeah.
Well, so, that was before we started, yes. That was two years ago.
You think that the fear of fanaticism is overstated in the book?
No, I don't think it's a fear of fanaticism. It was what I meant is when I first read it, I could hardly believe it. I must say, having worked on it for a year and a half or two now, everything became totally believable to me. Actually, I thought it wasn't science fiction. It was totally contemporary while we were doing it. Even though, I mean, it's not fascist, but all you need is a turn of the screw and you might be there sometimes.
Do you have a vision of what an American fanaticism or fascism would be like?
Oh, it'd be a very friendly one, I guess, because it would be run by advertising people. I mean, every country would, go for his own blend, and I think salesmanship would be the blend of an American totalitarian society. I still don't believe it would happen, and I don't think it has to happen. It's not what Margaret Atwood says. She says not it is going to happen. She says what if, and from there on, then it's more like a nightmare, and a nightmare doesn't need to have reality to it. It's based upon fear, and I think the fear is real.
Many of your films have been adapted from novels. How close do you feel like you have to stick to the text when you're directing a film based on a novel, especially a well-known novel?
Well, whether it's known or unknown is not the question, and it is not the text you have to stick to. You have to find out what is the secret engine within this novel that makes you turn the pages so that you keep reading. You better find that engine or that motor and have it work for your movie. And I think that's the real way of being truthful to it. Sometimes you have to change the entire structure, sometimes not. And then, you know, if you follow that inner logic of a novel, well, then you're bound to be somehow truthful to whatever its message, its characters, or how you want to tell it. I mean, truthful to its quality.
The Handmaid's Tale is your first American theatrical feature. Are there any big differences in directing American actors than German actors? I'm thinking, have many of them come up with different training techniques?
Yeah,
European actors, yeah.
Well, they are, I mean, at least we Europeans have the feeling that American actors are somehow more physical and therefore more apt for movies. You know, I mean, they're less cerebral, they're more somehow committed to a certain character. They try to identify with the part rather than to perform it and to pretend being that part. That certainly is a difference. I find them extremely open when working with foreigners. That struck me from my very first experience with John Malkovich and Dustin Hoffman. The enormous
that was in Death
trust,
of a Salesman.
That was in Death of a Salesman. The enormous trust, you know, they gave me. And I don't think that that European actors would be that open. And I felt so welcomed. I think it's because of the actors that I did stay in the country. I came, it was supposed to be a 3-month stay to do The Death of a Salesman. It's been 5 years now that I've settled down in New York.
Film director Volker Schlondorf is my guest. His new movie is The Handmaid's Tale. Where were you when the wall started to come down in Germany? Were you in the States or were you in Germany?
You wouldn't believe it. I was on my way from New York to Boston on the shuttle to the first preview of The Handmaid's Tale, and the first preview I ever experienced in my life. So I was very excited sitting on that plane when the captain's voice came over, not to give you whatever flying altitude and outside temperature this time, but just to let me know that the wall just came down and had been opened. And I broke into tears to my great embarrassment because I didn't know I was a patriot to that point. And there was a lot of friends around me who all came to that screening, the people I'd been working with. But they were just as cheerful as I was. It was just overwhelming.
What were the emotions behind the tears?
Well, I wish I knew. I hope it wasn't patriotism. I think the first emotion was, you know, when a wall comes down, any prison wall, everybody is overjoyed. And the next step was, the next joy was, I wish I'd be there. I'd love to shoot that. I love to do documentary stuff. And yet here I have to go and see what the audience's reaction to The Handmaid's Tale is. And the third thing is Europe will never be the same again, and because a lot of things are going to change, and these people, you know, are going to come west, and they're going to challenge us, and we're going to go east, and we're going to challenge them. And this continent, which I left because I felt it was like a big museum where you couldn't touch any piece just to, you know, take off the dust from time to time, but was basically very dead in the 80s, and as against the United States, which where everything feels so temporary and everything is still in the making, gave me great hope that Europe may somehow become alive again.
What are your reactions to the reunification of Germany?
Well, you know, I'm among those who are just very joyful about it. I think it's a great thing. And it would be wrong to suppress those feelings of joy. The control of that joy will come later. So my first movement is, I think it's a very positive thing for everybody, and it could be a very positive thing for Europe. The next fear, of course, it'll just become a big supermarket. I'm not afraid of any military power taking over. I think it'll just become maybe a big consumerist society, and that would be a pity after 40 years of sacrifices those people made in the name of certain values, that they have to throw those values overboard. I hope we can keep them up.
Are you anxious to go to East Germany?
I've been there a week before last, actually to show The Handmaid's Tale in another preview in East Berlin in a large 2,000-seat theater. And I thought they'd respond very positively to it because now they just had the experience, you know, of being within a wall, such as the wall Margaret Atwood describes in her novel. And that's no coincidence because she started writing the novel in Berlin while the wall was still up. And she took a lot of inspiration, I guess, from the regime on the other side of that wall. So I thought these people understand the picture, which indeed they did. But nevertheless, they were a little angry at me because they said, now listen, we just made it to the West now. We just opened up to the West. Don't give us such a grim picture of the West.
What was your response to that?
Well, I said, you'll find out for yourselves.
So this screening, was this part of a film festival?
That was part of the Berlin Film Festival, right, which for the first time this year was held on both sides of the wall. And, of course, for us, it was more interesting to screen it in the East than in the West.
So what was your responses to being in East Berlin?
Well, I've been there many times before. You know, you could we Westerners could go there, and especially if you're an artist, you have certain privileges. They have shown, like, The Tin Drum, Lost Town of Katharina Blum. They even shown the Salesman there, no doubt to warn their populations against the U.S. and the American dream. No, so this is... not been the first visit, but it's been a very, very different visit because you just walk across. You don't have to stay in line for 2 hours and body search and visas and stuff and grim faces. And it is at the same time so strange because it's the very same bureaucrats or policemen, or how would you call them, who had the grim faces and now smile. And it is very strange. How come people can change overnight that way? Are they smiling now because they are ordered to smile?
Well, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is film director Volker Schlondorf. His new movie is an adaptation of Margaret Atwood's novel, The Handmaid's Tale. His other films include The Tin Drum, Swan in Love, and The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Film director Volker Schlondorf is my guest. Would you like to be making more movies in Germany now? I'm wondering what the state of the German film industry is. I've heard some complaints that some of Germany's best directors have left the country and that's been kind of sapping the greatest energy of the German film industry.
Well, I don't really know. You mean probably Werner Herzog and Wim Wenders and myself. Well, yet we are working, so we still feel we are part of the industry. We don't care much what flag we work under, as long as we are working and we are all active. It was just that, I mean, like everywhere else, the 80s were a rather apathic period in Germany, while the 60s and the 70s, you know, had been a big shake-up. And so the films can only reflect the society they are made in. And I guess we left because we needed something else. And this looks like a promising decade, I would say, for European filmmaking, you know.
You were in the vanguard of the new German cinema of the 60s and 70s. Do you think of there being anything that holds together those films, either thematically or stylistically?
you know, I'd rather not reflect upon it.
Why not?
One of the things, yeah, it's very funny. You know, we were forced into theories and to recognize ourselves in systems of thoughts. And, you know, and like the new German cinema became like almost a doctrinarian thing, what it could be and what it couldn't be. And maybe one of the reasons why I felt so good when I moved to the United States is that generally you're not asked these introspections and these analyses, and you just, you know, it may keep you more fresh, speaking of fresh air, and more alive, not to analyze yourself that much while you're being creative. And maybe the end of the German wave was that it became too catalogized. I mean, it became too much, you know, everybody had his label and you had to stick to that label. And as a result, things turned sort of dead. Werner Herzog couldn't make a movie unless it was really weird and wild, and Wim unless it was really romantic and this and that. So it is quite normal that an artist of any temperament, you know, would break away from that.
Well, you actually spent a lot of your formative years as a filmmaker outside of Germany. You went to school in Paris when you were a teenager and stayed there. Your early film work was as an assistant to the French directors Louis Malle, Jean-Pierre Melville, Alain René.
Yeah, I've always been a traveler. I don't know. I guess once you start, you know, living out of a suitcase, you can never quite stop. And I just bought a new one, actually.
Did you feel that you were in France working with Malle and Melville and René while certain innovations or breakthroughs were being made in the French New
France.
Wave?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. This was a very, very exciting period. You could feel it on the set every day. I mean, we just stopped shooting in a certain way. The cinematography changed. You just did everything against the rule. You were breaking any rule that had ever been set up by the industry. And that's, I mean, if you have some anarchy in your blood, you know, it is just a great thing to do. And it's even better when you see that this fantasy and this freedom, which I, you know, try to keep in my filmmaking wherever I go. You know, it's like when I came here to do The Handmaid's Tale, I brought my cinematographer, Igor Luther, who had to leave Czechoslovakia in 68 and who I've known ever since. I brought him over here and we worked our ways. You know, we brought our kind of equipment. We wanted to make an American movie, but we wanted to make it the European way. We wanted, you know, to be as free and innovative, and the response of the technicians, same as it has been with Michael Ballhaus's work. You know, when we worked on The Salesman, the response is terrific. You know, there's all these young technicians and people coming out of film schools and very eager to change the rules of Hollywood. You know, they go with you, they support you. It's a great enthusiasm in this country, and most people are actually unhappy with Hollywood movies.
To what extent do you think that Germany during World War II, the Third Reich, has been either an explicit or implicit theme of your work?
Well, probably it is just ever present, and it's probably very present in The Handmaid's Tale too. Which, if you have some historical perspective, I mean, you were just not born in 39, and as I was, and then grow up in the years after the war and learning what had all been done somehow in the name of your nation, in the name of your culture, by your parents or, you know, by people you still live with and who's surrounding you. Basically, it's the same society. I mean, I hope it'll be lifelong, and I hope it'll be in the generations to come. Actually, I'm sure of that because I know from Margareta's son, who's 25, half my age, he's totally obsessed with the history of the country and how that could happen. And now the reunification poses the same question again to a whole new generation when they are told, okay, you may be one people again, like any other people, but, you know, you better watch it. So it is, I think this is an indelible duty somehow for many, many more generations.
You're talking about what it's like when you learn certain things about your country. Do you remember when it was that you first learned about the death camps?
Oh, I must have learned about it somehow here and there in school, but very consciously as I went, when I first came to France and I was 16 years old, in the province town somewhere out in Brittany, I went one afternoon to see Nuit et Brouillard, Night and Fog, Alain René's movie on the camps. And, I mean, that just, I mean, shocked me, you know. It's you knew about those things from paper, but you had actually never seen it. Now, this was way back, I don't know, in 56 or so. And, well, you just know, you know, you will never forget that afternoon and what you saw there. And this is like a life commitment in some ways to... You know, I mean, you don't even need to say in a moralistic way, this is a going, this has to be a commitment to you. The moment you see it, you know, you'll never be the same again.
I know in many German families, children growing up really wanted to know from their parents what their involvement was in the war. Were there confrontations like that in your family?
Well, yeah, sure, but you never could get anywhere. You know, the older generation just didn't want to talk about it, you know, calling it an unpleasant period, an accident in history, and a thing to be forgotten and better not mentioned about. You know, that was just almost the universal attitude, and I guess that's why we kept digging at it.
So do you feel that you never really learned about your father's role or lack
of
a role in the
war? Well, you know, everybody has his story, you know, and it is hard to question your very own, your physical parents. It's easier to question people who you are not immediately related to. And I think that's true for everybody. I just don't see a kid asking, you know, his father, what did you do in Vietnam, you know, and what did you feel when you dropped napalm or so. It is just not a question you can ask your physical father. It's almost impossible.
How are you dividing your time now between Germany and the United States?
Well, I've been living for the last 5 years in New York with, say, like every 2 months a trip to Europe, meaning I live in constant jet lag.
Right.
It's always day or night somewhere. And, well, the good thing is there's always a friend you can call because it, somewhere it's always the right time. But, no, I've mostly been spending 10 months a year in this country and... I'm still very excited about being here.
If you made, do you plan on ever making another film in Germany?
Well, yes, actually, I'm starting next week a movie with Sam Shepard, but it's a German novel by Max Frisch, Homo Faber. We call it Last Call for Passenger Faber. And that's an American engineer commuting between Europe and the United States, working here and there. And we'll shoot part of it actually in Germany and in France and Italy, and part of it over here. So it, I think it should somehow reflect my own transatlantic experience.
Do you have any speculations on how reunification might affect the life of a German filmmaker?
Well, yeah, I thought I'd stay for 10 years solid now in New York and make American movies, whereas ever since November 9th, I feel like going back this fall. So how more could you be affected? I don't really know what is going to happen, but it shows, fortunately, you can't make plans in life.
Volker Schlondorf, I thank you very much for talking with us.
Okay, thank you.
Volker Schlondorf's new film, The Handmaid's Tale, stars Robert Duvall, Natasha Richardson, and Faye Dunaway. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Next time, Joe Salerno tells about testifying against the mafia. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When you go to the supermarket, you probably make your selections based on things like price, quality, and advertising appeal. Alice Tepper Marlin says you can also choose based on the environmental, social, and employment practices of the manufacturer. Coming up, shopping for a better world. Also, what's the Italian word for schlemiel? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg considers the problems of translating movies and literature. And Dr. John plays us some Mardi Gras music. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua has demanded the immediate demobilization of the U.S.-backed Contras as a condition for the orderly transfer of power to the new government elected on Sunday. Alan Tomlinson has more on the story.
Ortega was speaking to a huge crowd of supporters outside a conference center where he'd spent much of the day assessing the future with 2,000 Sandinista Party militants. He told the crowd that a change of government did not in any way signify the end of the Nicaraguan revolution. The Sandinistas in opposition, he said, were responsible for defending revolutionary achievements. That meant defending the integrity of the Sandinista army and the interior ministry, an indication that Ortega will resist pressure to hand over control of the security forces to the new government. Ortega demanded the immediate dismantling and disarmament of the Contras, without which, he said, there could be no orderly and peaceful transfer of power. From Managua, I'm Alan Tomlinson reporting.
And the Contras' military chief is quoted as saying that they will not lay down their weapons until the Sandinistas turn over power to the opposition on April 25th. The White House today denied a report that there had been secret hostage talks held with Iran. White House Press Secretary Merlin Fitzwater said that President Bush is not aware of the source of these stories about secret talks held in Geneva or any talks that fit this description. A joint NATO-Warsaw Pact meeting in Ottawa today ended on a sour note. The conference, which opened 2 weeks ago, wrapped up much further from an agreement on an open skies treaty than had been anticipated. NPR's Richard Reynolds reports.
The conference began in a swirl of attention on February 12th. The foreign ministers from all 23 NATO and Warsaw Pact nations arrived in Ottawa for the opening ceremonies and left 2 days later, all saying they were optimistic an open skies treaty would be in place this year. That now seems much less likely. The idea behind open skies is simple. All the signatories would allow unarmed surveillance planes from the other countries to overfly their territory to monitor compliance with arms control agreements. But the Soviet Union now stands alone with a different idea of what the treaty should look like. The Soviets want all the information gathered by the planes to be shared. NATO and most East European nations object. The two sides also remain at odds over the kind of monitoring equipment that could be used. For National Public Radio, I'm Richard Reynolds.
For the first time in 23 years, the Israeli embassy in Warsaw is open as diplomatic ties between Israel and Poland have been restored. During the 1967 Middle Eastern War, Poland broke off ties with Israel. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 14.5 points to close at 2,617.12 and only moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. It's Mardi Gras time in New Orleans, and we've got some music to celebrate from New Orleans pianist Mac Rebenack, who also goes by the name Dr. John.
Right now I'd like to play a little Mardi Gras Indian music of New Orleans. Every year at the Mardi Gras, the Indians have been doing this song forever, and all the Indian tribes in New Orleans, the Yellow Pocahontas, the Young Sons of Geronimo, the Wild Chapatulas, all the Indians do it, the Wild Magnolias, all the tribes do this song in particular, thing called Aiko Aiko.
If you don't like now what the doctor say, you got the Chacomo Fina need now. But I go, I go, I go, I go, ande. Chacomo Fino and ande. Chacomo Fina need now. my spy bar to your spy bar. They were sitting along the bayou. My spy bar to your spy bar. I'm gonna set your tail on fire. You talking about here now, here now. I go and Jack and Mofino and Dandy, Jack and Mofino and Dandy. When I look at my queen all dressed in red, I go and day. Well, I bet you by daughter she gon' kill you dead, Jack and Mofino and Dandy. Well, maybe cheat me, got a golden crown, I go and day. Sin and I bend my knee, but I won't bow down, Jack and Mofino and Dandy. Talking about here now, here now. Aiko, Andy, Giacomo, Fino, and Andy, Giacomo, Fino, and Nilda. Team Marini on Dressing Rain, that was Aiko, Aiko, Andy. With an engine red feather in me head, Jack and Mofino I need. Well, I remember that morning, I remember it well. I remember that morning when Brother John fell, Jack and Mofino I need. When I curry died on the battlefield, I said when men and one turn, one by one kneel, Jack and Mofino I need. Talking about him now. Hit now, Aiko, Aiko, Andy. Put Jack and Mofino and Andy. Jack and Mofino and Andy.
Keeping in the Mardi Gras tradition of New Orleans music, I'd like to do you a little thing. It was written by Earl King for the great Professor Longhair. I had the pleasure of recording on a Gumbo album called Big Chief. And this was a very inspirational tune, as well as a song that was picked up by all the Mardi Gras Indian tribes of New Orleans. And it goes a little something like this. Big Chief. I'm going to leave you with a little thing we do every year, too, called a mess around, and we have a lot of fun with the cow-cow blues mixed in with it.
to Mac Rebenek for helping us celebrate Mardi Gras. This is Fresh Air. Supermarkets offer us lots of brands to choose from and everything from soup to toilet paper. We make our choices based on price or taste or durability or packaging. The Council on Economic Priorities suggests another standard to help us decide, the social responsibility of the manufacturer. The CEP is an organization that evaluates and encourages corporate social responsibility. It publishes a pocket-sized guide called Shopping for a Better World. The guide rates the social responsibility of 168 companies and their 1,800 products, as well as the supermarket chains that stock them. Alice Tepper Marlin is the founder and executive director of the council and one of the authors of the guide. I asked her why publish a shopping guide rather than encouraging a more familiar expression of disapproval, the boycott.
It takes an awful lot of organization to focus on just one company and get a nationwide boycott going. And you only occasionally buy the companies, the products from those companies. What we're doing with Shopping for a Better World is a concept we call selective buying, which enables you to decide for every single purchase you make, if you don't have a real favorite brand already, to pick the one with a better social record and stay away with the one that you might want to boycott or you might want to just avoid. It's much more comprehensive.
Now, tell us how you grade the companies that you grade in Shopping for a Better World.
We grade them each separately on 11 different criteria because we just provide the information. It's up to the individual to make their own value judgment to decide which issues are important to them and in some cases even which grade they like. So we rate a company separately on their giving to charitable institutions, promotion of women, promotion of minorities, animal testing, disclosure of social information, relations with their community and unions, environmental protection, and family benefits. And then there are three criteria where we just say yes or no and give you information. Those are nuclear power, South Africa, and defense contracting. We've polled nearly 1,000 of the people who use Shopping for a Better World. And we found that most of them, the vast majority of them, care deeply about all 11 of the issues. But the one that matters the most to people is the environment. And there are some people who care only about one or two of those issues. So we've organized Shopping for a Better World so that they can just look down the column and find the companies that perform best in the issues they care about.
One of the categories that you mentioned that you evaluate companies on is disclosure of social information. What does that mean?
That's like a community right-to-know issue. That means that when we or a member of the general public ask them whether they have any minorities or women among their top officers, or whether they test on live animals for consumer products, or what their environmental record is, they're willing to provide us with the information, either by answering a questionnaire or an interview or by publishing the information in their annual report.
Say I'm the head of a big company, and you've just sent me your questionnaire to evaluate my company. And I don't really want to participate in this, so I'm not going to send it back. What's your next move?
Well, our next move is to telephone them and try to persuade them that, number one, we do a really fair and balanced job, that we're not out with a hatchet to get any particular company. Then, number two, that we're very good researchers, and that if they don't give us the information, we'll be able to dig up a lot of information from other sources, from government files, from library research, from interviews and research with other public interest groups that work on the issues we're concerned about, from academic sources. Then we go through the process of looking through all those other sources for information, and we send the company back our preliminary grades. At that point, a lot of companies that originally said, I don't want to be part of your survey at all, and thought that by not responding to the questionnaire, we would be forced to drop them from the book, or just to have a nothing but a line of question marks, find out that we've been able to dig out a lot of information from other sources. Or they may begin to think that all those question marks aren't going to really impress consumers. And then they're quite tempted to give us additional information. Some of them fill out the questionnaire at that point. Others are given an opportunity to say why they think a grade we've given them is wrong and give us evidence to change our mind. And in fact, they often do convince us to change their mind. We make quite a few adjustments in the ratings before we publish them on the basis of feedback from the companies themselves and also from our board of independent advisors who review all of those ratings.
What are the companies that rated highest this year in your overall rating?
We have an honor roll of 15 companies that got top grades in at least 9 of the 11 categories. That includes Avon Products, Ben & Jerry's, Celestial Seasonings, Dole Fam, that's a little company with 24 employees that makes Old Monk olive oil and Sterling cider, Eastman Kodak, General Mills, Johnson & Johnson, Kellogg's, 3M, they make Scotch tape, Newman's Own, Polaroid, Procter & Gamble, Quaker Oats, Sara Lee, and Tom's of Maine, another small company that makes all-natural toothpaste and shampoo.
I guess what I find interesting about that list is that it's a combination of old companies and newer companies who defined themselves in an alternative business type of way. So you've got the established companies and new companies represented in there.
That's right. And it's been very exciting over the last decade to see a number of new companies like Ben & Jerry's and Tom's of Maine that were founded for a social purpose from the very beginning and have tried in a comprehensive way to evaluate their social performance and to achieve social goals as part of their basic business goals.
Do you have an opposite of an honor roll?
Yeah, we sure do. We have a dishonor roll, what we call our 4X Club. Those are companies that have gotten X ratings in at least 4 of the 11 categories. And they include American Home Products, which makes Chef Boyardee, Easy Off, and Woolite, Castle and Cook, which makes Dole canned fruits and juices, Kimberly Clark, which makes Kleenex and Huggies disposable diapers, USX, maker of Marathon Gas, Reynolds Metals, maker of Reynolds Wrap, and a small natural food company called Eden Foods.
Let me ask you, say one of the companies that scored high in your evaluation started saying, you know, recommended by the Council for Economic Priorities in their book, Shopping for a Better World. Would you feel like that was exploitation of your organization, or would you be behind using that for advertising?
No, we would certainly feel it was exploitation. And here's the reason. We don't evaluate the individual products. We are not competing with Consumers Reports here. To get an evaluation of an individual product, you need to turn to Consumers Reports or for nutrition to Center for Science and the Public Interest. We evaluate the social record of the companies behind the products, not the products itself. So the fact that a company gets a good social rating does not by any means mean that every single one of the products that they sell is a product that we think is good. In fact, there are a number of products here that we don't advise anyone to buy. But if they're going to buy them anyway, we'd rather they buy them from a more socially responsible company.
Now, I have to tell you, I always feel when I make my Saturday foray into the grocery that I don't have enough time to buy food, let alone to do research on, which product is the most is made by the most socially conscious manufacturer. Do you run into that a lot?
Well, I think that's a personal value judgment, and many of us take the time to volunteer for the causes that we care about. We may think we never have enough money, but we still find some money to make out a check to support the causes that we care about. We don't have time to vote, but it's a responsibility that we carry through on. And it takes a little extra time to think about their social responsibility, but not much. And I'll tell you that I mind the boredom of shopping much more than I mind the time of shopping. One reason I mind taking the time to shop is that it's boring.
Let me shift to another subject that the Council for Economic Priorities researches, and that is military spending. For years, you've been turning out reports analyzing the amount of money being spent on weapons and the need for those weapon systems. How are your sense of priorities shifting now in this period of glasnost, in this period of democracy moving into the Eastern European countries, the monopoly of the Communist Party in the Soviet Union ending?
Well, we've turned almost all of our effort in this area to two issues which we've looked at before but have never been our central focus. One of those is the challenge of how to help companies to and communities to adjust constructively to cutbacks in military spending through conversion of plants and through community economic adjustment planning to attract new sources of employment to the community, to provide job training for people whose jobs are threatened, to bring some kind of state, city, and federal aid focused on the areas where there may be dislocation because of cutbacks in military spending. We've always found, when we've looked at it closely, that spending on civilian production is better for the economy as a whole than is spending for military production. The other area where we have refocused our effort is a joint project with the Soviet Academy of Sciences to look at how our two countries can work together constructively on the arms control process to introduce common security arrangements in Europe and to convert our weapons production facilities in both countries to peacetime purposes.
Alice Tepper Marlin is founder and executive director of the Council on Economic Priorities and co-author of Shopping for a Better World, a guide to socially responsible supermarket shopping. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what stories do you have coming out of Nicaragua?
Hi, Terry. Tonight we're attempting to answer some questions, important ones. Can the UNO coalition in Nicaragua form an operative government? What's the future for the Contra forces? What's the effect on the region after a communist defeat in Nicaragua? Other stories, Mikhail Gorbachev is given stronger powers as president of the Soviet Union. Andrei Kadrescu has some thoughts about Fat Tuesday, Mardi Gras, in New Orleans. Also, I'll talk with Bo Dallas. Mr. Dallas is the chief of the Wild Magnolias, one of the black Indian tribes celebrating the Mardi Gras. Their music is rarely recorded, but now it's released.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Translators give us access to the books and movies of other cultures. But what are we missing when we read the translation of Crime and Punishment? And what are Europeans missing when they see dubbed versions of Woody Allen movies? Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg has some thoughts on the art of translation.
My friend Letizia earns her living translating English language books and movies into Italian, usually for pitiful fees and under imminent deadlines. When I lived in Rome, she used to call me at odd hours with queries about words that she couldn't find in the dictionary. I remember when she was translating the script of the movie True Confessions, which was thick with 1940s police jargon. The Italians do these films with overdubbing, not subtitles. One night, we spent an hour looking for an Italian equivalent for slasher that had exactly two syllables, so the actor's lips and the soundtrack would stay in sync. Letizia's problem with slasher is an example of the most notorious difficulty that translators have to deal with when a word or phrase in the original language has no equivalent in the new one. What does an Italian translator do when she comes to Philip Roth's use of schlemiel in Portnoy's Complaint? If she's cautious, she could go with some rough equivalent like the Italian word for fool. But that loses the spice of the original and leads to that bland style that often makes translations read as if you're hearing the original text over a bad telephone connection. Or she can look for a colloquial equivalent in the new language. But that has its perils, too, because colloquial words can often sound comical in the mouth of a foreign character. There's a nice example in a passage from Francis Stiegmiller's translation of Madame Bovary, where Emma is coming to grips with her mounting frustration with her husband Charles. It reads, "She went into the hall, opened the window, and took a breath of fresh air to calm herself. It's pathetic," she whispered to herself, despair in her heart. "What a booby." But things aren't just lost in translation. Sometimes they're added, particularly when the new language forces the translator to say more than is explicit in the original. This is what translators like Letizia have to deal with when they render an English language book or movie into one of the European languages that makes a distinction between the familiar and formal ways of saying you. Italian does this with tu and lei, French with tu and vous, Spanish with tu and usted, German with du and sie, and so on. This means that every time somebody in an English language movie refers to somebody else as you, the translator has to make a decision about the social relationship between the characters. This may require some delicate switching. In the Italian version of Superman, Clark Kent addresses Lois Lane with a familiar tu. But when he changes to Superman, he uses the more formal pronoun lei, since Lois and the Man of Steel have a less intimate relationship. Of course, once Lois learns Clark's identity in Superman 2, he starts using the intimate form even in his Superman role. As a general rule, characters switch from formal to familiar address after their first kiss, but there are exceptions. In the Italian Casablanca, for example, Humphrey Bogart at first addresses Ingrid Bergman with a formal pronoun when she shows up in Rick's cafe, as if he doesn't want to acknowledge their earlier intimacy back in Paris. And for some reason, the Italian translator of Hitchcock's Vertigo has Jimmy Stewart addressing Kim Novak with a formal lei throughout the film, even in the second half when he's making love to her. In both cases, the choice of the pronoun lends a delicate nuance to the relationship, one that's only implicit in the English versions. It's a nice reminder of how a translation is always a particular interpretation of the original. There's a well-known Italian adage that goes, traduttore, traditore, translator, traitor. And yet sometimes what translators betray is the truth.
Jeffrey Nunberg is a linguist associated with the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person with assistance from Joan Tui and Roberta Shurrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Joseph Salerno tells us about turning against his mafia friends, joining the Witness Protection Program, and testifying in the trial that brought down the Philadelphia mob. Also, we meet Laurent Dobrunov. Since the 1940s, he's continued the Babar the Elephant series created by his father. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.